91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today, it's South Florida legend Edna Buchanan. Her years as a Miami Herald crime reporter helped begin a long-held dream, writing fiction. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. A female newspaper crime reporter writing about what was then America's drug-crazed criminal paradise made readers and editors crave more. She won a Pulitzer Prize in 1986. It's said she covered more crime than most cops. Sometimes she risked personal danger, and yet often she wrote remarkably profound obituaries. Her career then surged in books prolifically. She wrote nonfiction, but really became a star with thrillers, including 10 featuring Miami crime reporter Britt Montero, naturally. Edna recently gained a Florida Humanities Lifetime Achievement Award. That's next after the news. And it's Joseph Cooper with today's Topical Currents. Wednesday edition, Bonnie Berman will be back tomorrow. But today we visit with South Florida icon Edna Buchanan. Since she moved to Miami Beach in the 1960s, she's professed great love for the place, and still does, of course. As a Miami Herald crime reporter, she saw Miami at its most gruesome and confusing during the 18-year run at the Herald. She had some 200 bylines per year in the paper, mostly crime-related, and she won a Pulitzer Prize. Then her prolific nonfiction and novel writing career bloomed, which included 10 mystery thrillers starring the character Britt Montero. Not surprisingly, Britt was a newspaper crime reporter. Britt wasn't nearsighted or clumsy. Edna Buchanan was recently honored by the Florida Humanities Council with a Lifetime Achievement Award. The ceremony was held in Tallahassee in April. Welcome to you, Edna Buchanan. Congratulations on your award. And I feel bad I haven't seen you in a couple of years at least.
Yeah, thank you. It's so good to see you again. You never change.
The years in Paterson, New Jersey, I was reading about, and you picked up the writing bug at around 4 years old. That doesn't seem possible,
yeah.
But you just were a sponge for reading.
Yeah, when I was between the ages of 3 and 4, it was like that golden hour, I guess, which I didn't realize at the time, my mother read to me. And I loved stories. I just absolutely loved them. And not too long after that, she got a job and had to work and then was too busy and couldn't read to me anymore. So I used to wander the neighborhood with a book under my arm and trying to get strangers or neighbors to read to me. And I always got turned down, even the mailman. I thought the mailman for sure would read to me when I showed my book and everything, and wouldn't do it. So I had to learn to read fast. And I did, and I started, you know, reading myself. I started reading on newspapers, and I loved it. And I met all the dark heroes of my childhood because we lived in the metropolitan area, you know, in New Jersey, just 17 miles from the George Washington Bridge. So I read all these wonderful newspapers, you know, the Daily Mirror and the Daily News and the Journal American. And there was another one. I can't remember the name of it.
So you were exposed to a lot of crime reporting.
Yeah, because I followed the adventures of Willie the actor Sutton, you know, who was the Babe Ruth of bank robbers, and Lucky Luciano, the man that organized the mob, and the Mad Bomber, who terrorized New York City, planting bombs in movie theaters and phone booths and things like that. And later, I got to talk to the Mad Bomber many years later when I became a reporter. And also, I wrote a piece about Lucky Luciano, but he was already gone. He was dead. But I also got to meet Willie Sutton and spent a lot of time with him because I snatched him up from this film crew that had found out he was moving to Sarasota, where his daughter lived. So my editors told me, we got a tip that Willie Sutton is, you know, he faked his way out of prison. He was still Willie the actor. He was sort of like a Robin Hood figure. He'd never really personally hurt anyone. And people sort of liked him. They thought he was like this, you know, basically good character. And they didn't want him to die in prison. He was dying. He was in a mess. And it was the winter. So there was a picture on the front page of the New York Daily News of him being wheeled out of Attica all hunched over. His hair was white. He didn't look anything like Willie Sutton. And several months later, he was in Miami, and he had red hair again, and he was taking dancing lessons, and he had a girlfriend. You know, he was really getting around.
Did you ever cross paths with Murph the Surf?
Oh, yeah, many times. He was an old friend. I knew him before the he started stealing and robbing, being a jewel robber. And I was friendly with him up until the time I realized he was just a cold stone killer. Everybody felt he was Robin Hood as well, but he wasn't. And I was there that last day, the last time he was arrested. It was a Sunday, and Alan Wofford, who was the widow of a hotel owner on the beach, she was at home with her little 9-year-old niece. And Murphy and two other guys knocked on the door Sunday afternoon, bright sunny day, and she answered it, and it was them. And Murphy, because he was so well known by that time, was wearing a mask made out of a pair of ladies' black sheer black panties, lacy panties, and he's wearing that over his head. And they demanded that she open her safe because they were after her jewels. And so she refused. She was a feisty little lady, and she refused. And they went and boiled a pan of water on the stove, and said they were going to pour it over her face when it had come to a full boil, over the little girl's face, her niece's face, if she didn't open the safe. So that was enough. She adored her little niece. And so she went in there and she opened the safe, but she set off a silent alarm. And soon the cops were on the way. And the response time on the beach can be forever now with the traffic. But at that time, the response time on the beach by police and fire rescue was like 2 minutes or less. And so they got there really fast. And one of Murphy's accomplices was outside, and he yelled in the door, you know, the police are here, they're everywhere. And so they scattered. And Murphy tried to get out a sliding glass door, and he couldn't. It was locked. And so he just backed up. You know, he was desperate to get away. And he just ran full blast at the glass door, broke through it. He got badly cut. But he kept going, but all three of them were caught right nearby, running along the seawalls in different directions. So they arrested him, and I got a tip about it. I forget how I heard it, that it had happened. I went out to the house. Murphy was gone. Soon other press began to arrive, and they were demanding to know where Murphy had been taken. And so the police announced to the assembled press that he'd been taken to Mount Sinai Hospital for his injuries. So then, as they all ran off to go to Mount Sinai, a cop whispered in my ear, we really took him to St. Francis. So I ran over to St. Francis, went right in. Security wasn't that big at the time.
St. Francis is long gone, of course.
St. Francis Hospital on 63rd sure. Street there. And so I just burst into the emergency room, and there he was in a cubicle, and a surgeon was sewing up a big gash in his knee, and he had a big another one over his eye. And he was sitting there in this little hospital gown, you know, handcuffed to the chair. And I said, Jack, what happened? Because he had promised he would never rob or steal again, that he was going straight, that he was going to write a book, and he was going to go teach kids how to stay out of trouble. And so it turned out that here he was, and I said, what happened? And he looked up at me and he said, I cut myself shaving. It was a great line that nobody else had in the paper the next day. And it was unbelievable. They arrested him for that robbery, and he never got out after that for a time because he was also a suspect in the Whiskey Creek murders. So they were holding him for that, too, those two girls that were murdered and dumped into Whiskey Creek up north, with he and Jack Griffith. And they were two secretaries who had embezzled, stolen some bearer bonds at the place where they worked in L.A. or someplace, and they had come here to try to get rid of them. They're negotiable. And so they enlisted Murphy and his friends to help them. And what they did was take the bearer bonds and killed both girls and dumped them in the drink. And they were two pretty girls in bikinis. And to make it worse, after they killed them, they slit their bellies open so the gases wouldn't... They didn't want them to be found. So they thought that the bodies wouldn't rise. They weighed them down and dumped them. But several days later, some fishermen saw a bare foot, the bottom of a bare foot sticking up out of the water, and they found them. And so Murphy went away for that. And the judge that sentenced him to I think, 5 life terms plus 100 years or something like that, he said he should never see the light of day. He should never walk among people, free people again. And that judge died thinking Murphy would be there forever. But he wasn't, because he was still Murph the Surf, and he had the gift of gab, and he convinced everybody he'd found Jesus. And the next thing you know, he got paroled. And when I heard about the parole and wrote the story, I interviewed this Miami Beach detective who had arrested Murphy a number of times, Emery Zurich. He was this crusty old cop. And when I said they're going to parole Murphy, he said he was furious. And he said, well, if I see him anywhere in Miami, Miami Beach, I'm going to blow his head off. I'm going to kill him. I'm going to shoot him on sight. And I put that in my story, and that sort of frightened the parole commission. So as a condition of his parole, they said he could not come back to Miami Beach. And so he's living on the west coast of Florida, up there by in Crystal River, Crystal River. And I heard from him a few times after that. He wanted me to help him get publicity because he wanted to write a book. He wanted to have a movie made about himself. But I never even responded to his calls because, you know, it might have been cute when he was doing this acrobatic theft at the museum, stealing the Star of India, you know, just like in those caper movies. But once you start killing women and pouring hot water on little girls' faces, I mean, that's the end of your Robin Hood, you know, your Robin Hood image.
Your recall of detail makes it so evident why you could churn out these mystery books, over 20 books to your credit. It's amazing. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think it was probably a little before you got to the Herald, but did you cover the Candy Mosler business?
I was aware of it. I was still working at
that was such a
the
big,
Beach Sun, I think.
Case,
yeah, and it. I did write a few stories about it. And then I wrote the story when she was found dead in the Fontainebleau years later. And it was really interesting because that body would have disappeared back to Texas.
It was the Central National Bank owner.
Yeah, with the S Bank. And her husband, Jacques Mosler, was murdered on Key Biscayne in their condo there. And she was having an affair with her nephew, and she and the nephew were charged with the murder.
Right.
But
the Miami News was putting out special editions.
Yeah, the pink sheet.
Yeah.
And the pink sheets were coming out every day with all the details. And then years later, she was still running a lot of the business, you know, the banks and things. And so she came to Miami Beach frequently and had a suite at the Fontainebleau. And so she was in and out of town quite often. And I get a call one day, and I forget who it was. Oh, I got a call from a reporter in Texas. And she said, we heard that Candy Mosler has died in Miami. And I said, not that I know of. And I called the police department. They knew nothing about it. I called. So I didn't think it really happened, but I went over there anyway and to just double check. And sure enough, I called the cops. You know, I had called the medical examiners. Nobody knew anything about the death of Candy Mosler. But it turns out I went over there, and I'm trying to remember. I called this detective, Stanley Steinbrecher, from the Miami Beach Police, and I think she's dead, and something's going on here. He came over, and he went up the stairs, and they had Candy. They wheeled her body out of the room, and they were taking it to the airport to take back to Texas without telling anybody here that she was dead or how she had died or what was going on or what happened to her jewelry, you know, because she always traveled with a lot of jewelry. So Stanley Steinbrecher, the detective, yelled at them and he said, put that body back where you found it, exactly the way it was. And he called for reinforcements, and they almost got her out of town.
So the coroner hadn't been there.
No, nobody had been there. Nobody knew. They weren't going to tell anybody that she was dead. They were just going to take her back home to Texas under the radar.
Well, this hour is flying by. We're visiting with famed crime reporter and author Edna Buchanan. We'll take a short break and be right back. And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper flying solo today. Bonnie Berman will be returning tomorrow. And we're visiting with South Florida icon Edna Buchanan. Edna, I made a little bit of a mistake in my open. I said you had about 200 bylines per year, but actually sometimes you were having 3 to 5 stories a day. So obviously you usually average much more than that.
Yeah, because I would go out and look for them all day instead of being just sent out on assignment by my editors. And I'd go to the police stations, Miami Beach.
And before word processing and the aid of computers. And
yeah, I could read all the handwritten reports. And they were really good reading, and I would find amazing stories. And like, if you found these stories, how could you not write them? And yet, a contingent of male reporters at the Herald, most of them were male at the time, they kept asking me to go to lunch. And I said, I don't have time to go to lunch. You know, I never eat lunch because...
Johnny Raffis, probably.
No, I never would go out to lunch or even eat lunch because we had a deadline around 2 or 3 o'clock, the first edition. And so, how you're on deadline, how could you go to lunch? So I never did. And I said, well, I don't go to lunch. And so finally they cornered me one day in a little room at the Herald. And they explained to me that I should only write one story a day, that I was making them look bad, that you just do one story a day and that's it. You don't write anything else. You kind of disappear or wander off or, you know, clean out your files or something. Just go off claiming to do research. But I love to write the stories. And if you find them, how could you not write them? And so they claimed that I had diarrhea of the typewriter and I should stop it. And I never did. And so a lot of them were upset about that because they didn't want to have to do more than one story a day. But I really loved finding the stories and writing them.
We'll get to your Carl Fisher and the Flag Day story in a minute. But
yeah.
I want to talk about, in journalism, of course, the lead, the L-E-D-E of a story is how you introduce it. And you're so famous for this one. And then I want you just to explain it. It's given as an example in journalism schools of how to be incisive and kind of clever at the same time. Gary Robinson died hungry.
Yeah. That story, Gary Robinson was an ex-convict, kind of a rough and tumble guy with an extensive rap sheet. And he walked into this little chicken place. I forget now if it was Kentucky Fried or one of the others, but it was this chicken place. He walked in rather late, close to closing time, and he tried to push his way to the front of the line. He'd been drinking, and he tried to push his way to the front of the line, and this feisty little girl behind the counter said, oh, no, you can't do that. You have to go wait like a gentleman at the end of the... And she sweet-talked him into going to the end of the line. So... he did go to the end of the line, and when he finally reached the counter, he tried to order some chicken, and she said, we're all out. We don't have any more chicken. I think it was chicken nuggets or something that he wanted, but they didn't have it. And he was so furious because he'd seen people ahead of him getting them, and he was so furious that they were now out that he punched her in the face, and then the security guard shot him. And so that was the lead of the story. Gary Robinson died hungry. And you couldn't use that lead with a lot of other stories, but given who he was and how he behaved and all that stuff, it wasn't making fun or anything, but it was just that, you know, his search for food.
The sadness.
Yeah.
The
irony.
Silly
stuff. Yeah.
So Flag Day, Carl Fisher.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is Flag Day. And I always remember Carl Fisher's right-hand man, Pete Chase.
Fisher, of course, for those listeners, the big shot of Miami Beach,
he was the first developer. He was the visionary that went to this mangrove-covered island with, you know, crocodiles and alligators and everything else on it, and covered, you know, with
invented
zillions
the
of Prestolite
auto
light. And he saw a great city. Nobody else saw it. In fact, his young wife didn't even want to go over there with him because it was too full of mosquitoes and animals and stuff, you know, creatures. So he was a great visionary. And like many great visionaries, he died broke, which was really sad. But Pete Chase was his right-hand man. Pete Chase would have the vision. No, Carl Fisher would have the vision, and Pete Chase would carry it through and do all the work and the planning. And he was a really wonderful guy, and he was still alive when I got to Miami in the 60s. And he had a big flagpole out in front of his house. Chase Avenue was named for him.
Right.
And you could always find him if you needed him because he was always there at sunrise to run the flag up the flagpole, and then he would be there at sunset to take it down. And so that was how you could always find him if you wanted to talk to him. And he was really an interesting, neat guy. And he was a widower at the time, and he lived there by himself. but he was full of wonderful history and everything, and I loved to talk to him. And so then, after he died, the first thing the city did, of course, was to knock down that historic house of his that was so wonderful, and knock down the flagpole. I mean, they have no respect at all for history over there. And they built the Chamber of Commerce there. I don't think they have a flagpole out front. I'm not sure. But the Chamber of Commerce building is now on that historic site where Pete Chase's house, longtime home, was. And all the, apparently, the historic things that happened there and everything have been sort of forgotten. But he was a great old guy, and I really liked him.
You had a, there's a quote here I want to read from your acceptance speech at the Florida Humanities Council. I like this. Nobody's better than a good cop. Nobody's worse than a bad cop. And sometimes they are the same cop, even on the same day. The problem is they must be recruited from the human race.
Yep.
Tell us more. Elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, you know, it was really tough. I was like the first woman to be on the police beat over there. And even the editors like really didn't want me to go to certain places and everything, but I always went. And one Saturday night, I always liked to work weekends because that was the busiest time on the police beat. And it was also the time when you could get more information at police headquarters because the brass wasn't there. They usually had weekends off, and I could talk, you know, to the rank and file and to the civilian employees and everything, and they'd give me information that I wanted, you know, and things like that. So I worked weekends, and some of the cops were like really difficult and mean and nasty, but I just kept coming back. And it got to a point where I would always go up to homicide because that's where the big, you know, the most important news was. And I would get thrown out of the police station all the time, that brand new station that they built over there, you know, by 2nd Avenue. And these cops were like, it was like us and them, you know, they didn't trust the press. And so just over time, some of them learned to trust me, or they did appreciate the stories that I wrote.
How did you gain trust? By omitting things that were important when it was important to do so?
And... No, but when it was funny because if they wouldn't talk to me about a case, I would just go out and work like crazy finding people that could give me the information because I always canvassed the neighborhood. I'd canvass the funeral home, the medical examiner's office, and get a lot of information.
Like
and sometimes I'd have more than they would, or they want call and want to know where I got the information. And so, and they said, why did you put that in the paper, like how many times the guy was shot? Because only the killer knows that, you know, and we need that to keep that information so we know. And if somebody confesses, it's really them. And so I sort of made deals when I said, okay, give me as much as you can. Tell me what you want me to leave out. That's not that really. And like they had this thing where they wouldn't give you the name of a victim until
family.
The family was notified. So I convinced them that I would not release it prematurely, but it would give me a chance to research at the Herald, look and
right.
see if these victims or of people involved in the case have rap sheets or have had stories about them or might have some clue to why they were killed. And so if they would give me the name to let me research it so I could write a good story, then I wouldn't put the name in until they said it was okay or until a reasonable time. And to me, a reasonable time was always like 24, 36 hours. And so we just slowly became, but the brass were always so mean to me. And it was funny because this one cop, this Lieutenant Gracie, used to throw me out of homicide all the time. And then these two brothers that were both captains, they'd throw me out of the station every time they saw me. Once into like this terrible storm that had blown up and the garbage cans were flying around the parking lot and it was pouring rain and my car was at the far end of the parking lot. And I said, well, could I wait here before I have to go out? And they said, no. And they chased me out into the storm. But then Lieutenant Gracie, who would always chase, you know, ban me from the building and chase me out of the building. He called one day at the Herald and he said, you've got to come over here right away. And, you know, we've got something to tell you. And so I said, okay. And he wouldn't talk about it over the phone. So I thought it's got to be a really big break in a case or something. And I didn't know if it was a press conference he was calling or if he just was going to tell me this. And so I told my editors, I'm going over there. They've got something going on at the headquarters. I'll let you know as soon as I find out. So I go over there, And I went into the police station, and nobody like bothered me about getting on the elevator and everything and going up there. And so I walked into the homicide unit, and I had forgotten it myself because I was really working that day. And they knew some, I guess because it's on your press ID, your date of birth, it was my birthday. And they had a birthday cake and coffee. And the guys in homicide all sang happy birthday. And we had this cake, and it was really nice.
It must have unhinged you.
And a couple days later, I went back to the police station and was up there, and Lieutenant Gracie threw me out again. So it was just, you know, it was interesting, an interesting relationship, and I managed to deal with it because I was thick-skinned anyway. I'm from Paterson, New Jersey. And so they could, you know, talk mean all day, but when the chips were down, they would help me, you know, when they could. And it was a good thing. One of them even saved my life once.
We'll get back to that when we come back. We're visiting with South Florida icon Edna Buchanan. We'll take another short break and be back with more. And we continue with Edna Buchanan. And on today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman returns tomorrow. Edna, you were just about to tell us how your life was saved by Gracie and the Miami cops.
Oh, yeah. Well, it wasn't Lieutenant Gracie. This was a Dade County cop.
Okay.
But it was the same thing with them because I had problems with E. Wilson Purdy, their boss, who, in fact,
long time.
He caught me up in a homicide one day sitting there talking with the detectives, which is how I usually just, among small talk, got a lot of information. And so he just stood in the doorway glowering at us and didn't say it, but he was a scary guy. He was a former FBI guy, and he was short and had this kind of Napoleon complex. He was really a strange man, and he just stood there, and the detectives just, like, stood there, you know, sat there horrified, and he just glared at us and went away. And I thought, well, that wasn't so bad. He didn't scream or yell. And then I went there 2 days later, and they had put up a steel door on the homicide office, and you could only go through there by having someone else verify your ID, and then one secretary was the only one who had the key and would let people in and out. And they called it the Edna Buchanan door. And until Purdy left, the Edna Buchanan door was still there. I doubt if it is, because they've moved, you know, things around a lot and everything. They've moved from place to place. But anyway, there was a plane crash years ago. You might remember it. It was the one where Christmas trees were aboard a cargo plane, and they were taking these Christmas trees somewhere, and they took off from the airport, and the load shifted. The Christmas trees hadn't all been secured properly, and the load shifted. He couldn't gain any altitude, and the plane just screamed down 36th Street and crashed right on 36th Street among the traffic there. So I went right over there, and it was just, do you remember that one? It was really awful. And the street was on fire because it had been loaded with fuel, and the burning fuel, and the street was on fire. People were killed, and it was really a terrible tragedy. It was in broad daylight on a weekday, and so some of the people there that were killed was like this this young guy who was in his car, and he saw the plane coming, and traffic, everybody had slammed on the brakes, and there was panic, and he couldn't move in traffic, and he jumped out and ran trying to get away, and the wing cut him in half. And then there was a young boy who should have been in school that day, but it was a teacher's work day, so he accompanied his dad to work. He had some kind of shop there, like an automotive shop or something, there on 36th Street. And the young boy, who was about 12-ish, honor student, great kid, who went to work with his father, when the plane hit and was wending its way, you know, its disastrous way down 36th Street, part of the wreckage hit that shop, and everybody escaped except the young man. The young boy was killed.
But your life being saved.
And yeah, so what happened was I was looking for a good vantage point to see out over everything because everything was so chaotic. And I happened to look up, and there was a 3- or 4-story apartment building there, an old one. And I saw on the balcony on the 2nd or 3rd floor was several homicide detectives from Metro, and they from PSD, I think it was at the time. And so they were up there watching and waiting for the flames to die down so they could go down and collect the bodies and see who was there and what happened. And so, you know, who's injured, who's dead, and try to, you know, gather the remains. And so I thought, wow, what a good idea. And the building had apparently evacuated, so no one else was in there. So I went in, climbed the stairs, went up out on the balcony where the detectives were. So it was a good place to be. And meanwhile, I'd been getting beeped like crazy from the Herald. They wanted me to get the exact path the plane took, all the streets involved, for a Herald artist to do a map for the paper. And so they were like beeping me. So there was a payphone or something there in the lobby. So I called up and said, okay, I'll get it. So then I went up and joined the detectives, and they're saying, what are you doing here? But they weren't mean or anything. They were nice. And so this detective, this homicide detective, Arthur Felton, was there. And he was this burly, sort of really outspoken cop. Did you know him?
I knew him.
Yes, Artie Felton. And so he was up there too. And I was sort of talking with them, but I had to get this. They were beeping me again. I had to get this information for the map. So I leaned over the railing trying to get the names of the street signs around us, and I couldn't see the one down at the end of the street. And so as I was leaning over, I said, what's the name of that? And the railing broke, and I started to fall forward down into the street full of burning fuel. And if the fall didn't kill me, it would have been really nasty. And so but as I was falling, I had a dress with a belt on, and Felton grabbed my belt and pulled me back up. And I'm convinced he did say, and he started to yell and scream, you know, because he was a real volatile guy. He was going, you're crazy. But as he pulled me back, I finished my sentence, that street down there, because I said, what was the name of? And that street down there. And when I finished the sentence, he started to scream, you're crazy, you almost got killed. But it was so traumatic being there that day and seeing everything that happened and seeing all the terrible tragedy and the disaster and the chaos, that I totally forgot that Artie Felton had saved my life. And two or three days later, I went over to Metro, to PSD, and I happened to see him. Up in homicide. And when I walked into the room, he started to scream and yell again, you're crazy. You almost got killed and you didn't even notice. And I said, I remembered it because I had totally forgotten it. And I thought, geez, and he never got any credit for it. It was never in the paper, and I should have written about it or something. I did write about it in one of the books very briefly, later, many years later. And he died suddenly at a young age.
Yes.
And he had a wife and a little girl. And I knew right away when I first met him, even though he was volatile and boisterous and this burly guy, he was a pussycat at heart because he was always mentioning his little girl and his wife and everything. And so he was a good man and a hell of a detective. He was a wonderful detective. And I was really I went to the wake. For some reason, I didn't get to go to the funeral, the burial the next day, but I did go to the wake. But I didn't get a chance to pay my respects to the wife because it was so crowded. You know, all the police people were there and the law enforcement and that. So, but I felt guilty ever since. So now whenever I go talk to a bunch of cops, I mention it. And there is a plaque somewhere and an annual award for something else that he did. But there was an annual reward now. It's not because of that, but right, because of his character and his record. They have an annual award, I think, to a really good cop, like the annual Arthur Felton award. But I've never seen the plaque. It must be hanging over there someplace.
You've mentioned troubles with the cops. You've mentioned being saved by the cops. But you've also had ongoing battles with your editors.
Yeah.
And this quote, I love your quotes, and this quote, to entrust to an editor a story over which you have labored and to which your name and reputation are attached can be like sending your daughter off to an evening with Ted Bundy.
Teenage daughter. Yeah, I remember that.
Worse, okay.
Yeah, I wrote that once. Yeah, yeah, because they can do terrible things to your stories. And sometimes these editors seem to be like overeducated. And some of them had always been editors. They'd never really been out there. After a while, they started sending editors out on the beat with me just for a day, just to see what it's really like out there. And I think that was a help. And then they started sending people from other divisions of the Herald with me out there. And so that was interesting, and it was probably really good for them to know more about what goes on out on the street. But one of them, some of them are just like vastly overeducated. One day, I went to the police station. I hadn't read the morning paper yet, the Herald, and I walked into Miami Homicide, and they were laughing at me. And they said, oh, you think you're a police reporter and you can't even spell homicide. And I said, what do you mean? You know, because I'd spelled the word 1,000 times, you know. And this editor, this small editor who had a Napoleon complex himself, he changed the spelling of homicide, which I had right. And he put it in the headline wrong. He spelled it H-O-M-O. And it was in the story wrong. And they were all making fun of, and I was furious. And I went back to the Herald, and I said, "What are you talking?" And I went up to his desk, and then he started to argue with me and tell me that he fixed it, and that's the way it should be spelled because he had once studied Greek or Latin or something, and it's always H O M O. It's not H O M I. And like he didn't before he changed it, he didn't even check a dictionary or maybe check with me, and it made me look like a fool. And that's what editors can do.
Well, they do it all the editors, time. How about headlines? As a writer, you don't write your own headlines.
No.
So you must have had some complaints there.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes the headlines have nothing to do with the story.
Somebody being too cute.
Yeah, they're just... and also, I used to take my own pictures when I worked for the first newspaper that I was at, the Miami Beach Sun. So I always used to illustrate the stories with my pictures I took. But at the Herald, the photographers didn't want me to take pictures. But my editor said, well, it's okay if you do. So I was taking pictures, and the photographers were enraged. They were absolutely enraged. And they almost killed me once because I didn't really know. I was using my own camera, you know, a little Yashica that I always used, and I only shot black and white and used natural light.
Tri-X.
And so they said, well, okay, if you're going to go ahead and take pictures, you might as well use a regular camera that we use. And they gave me the camera, and it was all set up, and it had the flash on it and everything.
Probably a Nikon.
And I'd never used it before and didn't know how, but I put it in my car. And a couple nights later, a building really close to the old Miami Beach City Hall was on fire, an apartment building. And so, and it would have been a great shot of the flames and the silhouette of the... City Hall, right in front of it, all these flames in the background and the fire. So I climbed up on a balcony. I did that too often, I guess. I climbed up on this balcony in a nearby apartment house, and people were there and everything. Somebody buzzed me in, and I went up, and I'm out on the balcony, and I'm trying to get the shot. I put one leg over the railing, and I'm trying to get the perfect picture. And when I clicked the shutter, I got a really bad electric shock. They had rigged the camera to make me stop doing that. But it could have made me fall off the darn balcony. You know, and I was... So I gave them their camera back, and I just didn't take any pictures after that because they really didn't like it. They were raising all kinds of hell. And I liked some of the photographers, and I didn't want them to hate me. So, but the next time, shortly after that, there was this great... story over there, and some of the editors, because I was relatively new, didn't trust me or thought I was just like a rookie and everything. And I had really gotten a lot of experience over at the Miami Beach Sun, even though I'd never gone to journalism school.
You have to do everything.
I did everything there. I knew how to set hot type and everything else, you know, long lost art. But I learned how to read upside down at the time, which came in handy. And so, you know, it was just too bad because I was at the police station researching some jewel robberies, which I suspected Murph the Surf of. So I was at Miami Beach Police Station, and I heard a 3 signal, which is a major, you know, it's an emergency, and then more of them. And a cafeteria, a restaurant that I'd never been in on Lincoln Road, had exploded. Apparently gas fumes from an adjacent building or something had built up under the roof, and the whole place exploded, and it was around lunchtime. And so I ran over there, and I quick called the Herald, and I said, there's a major explosion, and they think people are trapped inside. People have apparently been killed. In fact, with the police, when they called the medical examiner to come, they said, bring body bags. We think we have a lot of bodies in there. But actually, when it blew up, thank heavens, the roof blew off and people just stampeded out the door. And there were some injuries, but nobody was killed. It was an amazing thing. But anyhow, there were dramatic pictures of cops carrying elderly people out of the cafeteria. And I didn't have a camera because they just stopped me from taking pictures. And this guy that answered the phone at the desk, at the news desk, when I said there's, and they could have seen the mushroom cloud in the sky because it was black smoke. The sky was full of it. But this guy Caperton, who was on the desk, he said, Eddie Buchanan just called and said there's been some kind of an explosion on Lincoln Road. Check it out and see if it's true. I'm like, oh, see if it's true. And so the photographer didn't arrive for hours. All of the great pictures of elderly ladies being, you know, with their faces bloodied, being carried out by these heroes. Some of them were waiters at the cafeteria. Some were cops. And the only person who was seriously hurt was a motorcycle cop who'd been riding by at the time of the explosion and got blown off his motorcycle. But most of the people who lived there were okay, who were dining there were okay.
What a story. Let's take a short break on our program. We're visiting with Edna Buchanan. We'll be right back. And we're back. Today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, minus Bonnie Berman with Edna Buchanan. Edna, something you said when you first came in to begin the program, that you were so sorry that Bonnie wasn't here, that you were really wanting to meet her. I certainly will express that.
Yeah, I think she's avoiding me.
She'd be very honored.
No. She's avoiding me because I've always wanted to meet her.
We'll have to have you back sooner.
She has the most distinctive female voice in all of NPR. And I love the way the delivery. She's really, really good.
She's a distinctive person as well.
Yeah, anyway. I was so looking forward to it.
Well, back to you. Of all your novels, do you have a fave?
Usually the one I worked on last, but they're like your children. Like you can't pick out really which one you like. They're all your favorite at some time or other. But, you know, you mentioned when we first began to talk how I love Miami. You know, and I love...
You still have that necklace on?
Not on anymore.
Oh.
You know, I still love Miami, and I have it, the necklace, but I still love Miami and Miami Beach, but I love it more for what it used to be than what it once was.
It's too bad.
You know, it really is sad because when we had all the terrible rises in crime and homicide...
1981, 637 murders. We led the league.
Yeah, and the file at the medical examiner's office says it was 622, but I still counted all the ones that were found buried, like in the Everglades, or burned in the Everglades in a box, because they didn't do that to themselves, but because they couldn't actually determine the cause of death. They're not classified yet, so if they're not classified, they don't count them in the statistics. So although the official count is 622, my count was 637, because these were bodies that couldn't have done this to themselves. And somebody had to put them there. So
we have a very convenient dumping ground out there.
Yeah, and at the time, it was so overwhelming, they said, just cover the major murder of the day. And I was always pretending to be shocked and that I didn't understand, because how can you select the major murder of the day? Everybody who's murdered wanted to live as much as you or I do. And so I made it my business. I thought they should all have their stories in the paper, of newspaper of record, on file forever. And I did it by hook or crook. I got every single one of them in the paper that year. And the Herald, you know, sort of didn't mind it. Sometimes they'd gripe. They didn't want it to be all crime, but sometimes I had to put like 12 murders in one big story, but I got all their names and stories in.
Of course.
So, but now, like, I'm shocked that there seems to be no value anymore in the press or at City Hall or even among some of the police departments about human life. Those three people killed in that freak accident on the Tuttle Causeway, I guess it was last month, where a guy on a motorcycle hit a guy on, and the story was more about how it caused all this terrible traffic and all the traffic problems they had. But what about the three dead guys? One was just a guy there fishing in the middle of the night when you get the best bites sometimes, and it was a moonlit night, and he got killed by the flying debris, and nobody even wanted to tell their stories or seemed to care about them. And back in the day, when I was covering all of those murders, it was interesting. There was a guy named William Wilbanks who was at FIU, and he wrote a book. He wrote a book about how the press handles homicides. And his theory was he would find that we ignored a lot because people were black and didn't count or something. Mm-hmm. But they picked that year, and every single one was in the paper. So it sort of ruined his premise, but he did write the book. And the Herald was very relieved and happy when they saw it, because otherwise, before, it might not have reflected that. But, you know, it's just... respect anymore for homicide victims.
Let me tell a story about that I tell people when your name comes up, my Edna the Buchanan story. It's that I was here late, 10 or 10:30 at night, and you were in the TV station doing an interview or something, and you were starting to go out the door, and I said hello to you, and I said, you know, Edna, let me walk you to your car. This isn't the greatest neighborhood. And you said, oh, don't worry about that, Joe. I'm packing a gun. Oh.
I don't remember that clearly, but yeah, probably.
So you've always been a very strong woman.
Well, I try.
And you've seen so much.
Yeah. Yeah, but I always thought we were doing some good, remembering the victims, not forgetting them, trying to find out what really happened and making sure it doesn't happen again. Like that poor guy, you know, that was happened to be fishing on the causeway or something. And he got killed, too, because of, you know, ignore the, it's hard to ignore any of the victims when you are so used to getting everybody's story. And that's one thing that I miss.
We only have like 30 seconds left, so I can't we can't elaborate on it. But just hearing your empathy there is why you were such a terrific, wonderful obituary writer, the best in the business. some of those that were so touching that you wrote about, because you did see, even though you were seeing these enormous numbers, you did see everyone as an individual who was perhaps in the wrong place at the right time and met the wrong person, and that
A
wonderful career you've had.
I'm so
proud that you were given the Florida Humanities Council Lifetime Achievement Award this year. That's just a small token of the appreciation for everyone who enjoys your work.
Thank you. I'm so happy to see you again. I haven't seen you for so long.
Yeah. You'll have to come back soon.
And I miss Bonnie. Yeah.
Yes, we will. We'll do that. It's been a pleasure. This hour has flown by, Edna Buchanan.
Yes. Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in this hour. Our lead producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from online content producer Jason Zabka. Polly Landis is associate producer. Perhaps a friend or relative would like to hear the interview of Edna Buchanan. It's easy to download all our programs at the website WLRN.org. Then there's the iTunes podcast as well as the Topical Currents Facebook page. And tomorrow's program has a pre-Father's Day flavor. First, the Fatherhood Task Force of South Florida. It's dedicated to creating more father figures in the area. It's also headed by a woman, Holly Zwirling. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining tomorrow highlights a father-son restaurant chain partnership. Some very amazing people. Joseph Cooper minus Bonnie Berman. She'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.